Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Happy to be here with you tonight and glad you decided to spend some time with us. A lot of you are not going to feel like going to work tomorrow. You're going to be up with us for the next 4 hours because this is not a subject that you can put up in the background, sort of listen for a while, and then gently drift off to sleep. Not even close. I know that's the case because so many of you have told me exactly that. Each time I've interviewed David Politis, the reaction from you, the Coast listeners, has been bigger and more intense than the time before. By now, a lot of other media folks have wised up to the mystery that Dave Politis allowed us to unveil a couple of years ago on this program. As you may recall, I first invited him onto the show to talk about his investigations into the Bigfoot mystery. He approached that subject with the same objectivity and rigorous investigatory techniques that served him well as a police officer and private eye. And now as an author and speaker, what started out as an idea for one book quickly mushroomed into two books, then three books, and now four. If you've heard David on this program before, talking about the missing 411 material, then you know what's in store for you tonight. If you haven't heard him previously, then prepare to have your world rocked, because this stuff is flat out weird. And while you might think you can come up with some sort of an explanation that'll help us all sleep better at night, to know deep down inside that we're all pretty safe, that nothing's going to creep or crawl out of the darkness to snatch us up, you don't. Hundreds, make that thousands of missing people, all vanished under strange circumstances, right under the noses of loved ones or traveling companions, disappearances that simply don't make sense, that seem to happen in geographic clusters, in bunches, same places, same kind of circumstances, same mind-boggling lack of explanations. Tonight, we devote all 4 hours to David's new book. This is his first major interview about this book, and he made a point of saying he wanted to unveil the material here on Coast for the first time. I finished reading the book this afternoon, and like the three earlier volumes, it is perplexing, confounding, and a page-turner, one that's tough to get out of your head once you start kicking it around. As we'll soon learn, the parameters of this mystery are even broader than we imagined, at least when we started this journey together. The cases go back even further than we might have thought, and they have occurred all over the world. Among the new material that we'll cover this evening, cases from Australia, the UK, Canada, Switzerland, South America, and pretty much every state in the USA, including Hawaii, which, if you'll recall, was sort of left out of the discussion in our previous interviews because we didn't really have much material from there. Simply put, the more we learn, the spookier this gets. As we will learn, the list of suspects or possible explanations is growing more narrow. Maybe you have some ideas on what it is. One thing we'll do tonight is to ask for your help in finding cases, newspaper accounts, even public records about this stuff, because it's going to require a lot of work and possibly public involvement if it's ever going to be resolved. And maybe it can't be resolved. Maybe the answer is out of our grasp, tantalizingly close, but always just a little bit out of our reach. The new book is called Missing 411, The Devil is in the Detail. Its author, Dave Politis, will join us momentarily. Hey, Nathan, if you're listening to me, I'm hearing a feedback in my headpiece. If you could get rid of that, it'd be a lot better for me. I appreciate it. A couple of quick news items were sent out. Cause of the fire is still under investigation. Tonight, the combat fire, that's one of them. It burned 6,500 acres. That's close to full containment. Another fire, which consumed more than 15,000 acres, is about 55% controlled. A former Coast to Coast guest, Tom DeLong of the band Blink-182, lives in that area, sent me some photos of these giant plumes of smoke coming within eyeshot of his building. Terrible damages caused to one of the prettiest parts of California there. In other news, the president of South Korea is vowing tonight to completely dismantle her nation's Coast Guard. That in response to what she called a complete disaster and the rescue operation launched after a ferry boat capsized last month. 300 are dead or presumed dead. Singer Jerry Vale, he's a crooner. You might remember him if you're an older person he became popular back in the 50s, has died. He was 83 years old, Jerry Vale. Still no answer in the search for the missing Malaysian jetliner, Flight 370. Have you given up expecting to ever get an explanation about what happened to that plane and all those people on board? I almost have. But this week, a renowned psychic, Uri Geller, sent me an email and said answers are coming and they're coming soon. Now, Geller has a pretty good track record. He's been eerily accurate in predictions in the past. It's how he makes his living these days, is predicting where people will find oil. He said in his note that in a very short time, we're going to know a lot more about what happened to that plane, saying that something would be found. And he's talking about the near future, not years or months from now. Not sure if that means wreckage or what, but we'll keep our ears open and see if Uri's prediction turns out to be accurate. At the box office this weekend, Godzilla stomped and mangled its opposition, earning $93 million in domestic box office, another $195 million internationally, second highest domestic opening of the year, $20 million more than its owners or producers projected, and they are already talking sequels, naturally. I'm told the movie has a Nevada connection. I don't want to spoil it, but I was surprised to hear that connection, which comes out in the film, is not related to Area 51, which, as you might know, has popped up in many blockbuster movies in the last couple of years. It was 25 years ago this past week when the term Area 51 first started to spread around the world. That's because of an interview we did with a guy in silhouette who called himself Dennis, but it was later revealed to be Bob Lazar. That interview, more than anything else, put Area 51 on the map. It led to movies and TV shows and books and merchandise, every product you can imagine, to the point that the name is pretty much known everywhere on the globe. Last week, as I hinted a while ago, I was able to get Bob Lazar to sit down with me to sort of do an update on the story. And whether you think he's truthful or whether you think he's a hoaxer, I am pretty confident you'll find these reports interesting because, like it or not, this meme about flying saucers hidden at a base near Area 51 is now kind of permanently carved into UFO lore. Webmaster Lex and I posted the two-part series about Lazar. We have it on the Coast website if you care to watch the stories. Should also mention that yesterday marked the grand reopening of the Area 51 exhibit, which is at the Atomic Testing Museum here in Las Vegas. A lot of UFO luminaries were on hand for the unveiling. Nick Pope, Colonel Halt of Bentwaters fame, John Alexander. It's a very cool exhibit and a wonderful museum overall. So if you're planning on visiting Las Vegas anytime soon, you might want to put it on your to-do list. Greetings to all our listeners at the McMenamins UFO Conference in McMinnville, Oregon tonight. I mentioned last year after I came back from that gathering, it's the most fun of any UFO conference I have ever attended, and I've been to quite a few of them. I wasn't able to get there this year, but plan to be back next year, and any year after that, I can manage it. Our colleague George Norrie was one of the featured speakers this year, along with Stan Friedman, Peter Davenport, and a list of other excellent investigators. Webmaster Lex and I put together an assortment of interesting news items and oddities culled from the headlines in the last week or so. I was both surprised and appalled to learn that the Pentagon has battle plans drawn up to deal with a possible zombie apocalypse. I'm not making this up. You can read about it in the link we put on our Coast website under Naps News. Also there, a Newsweek story about various conspiracy theories, most of which will be familiar to Coast listeners. Why belief in conspiracy theories is growing and why it might be dangerous, according to the author of this article. Interesting piece, but I think it'll probably raise your hackles, at least a few of these items. Another cool story there, an article about what comes next for the internet. One writer says there's an internet of things coming around the corner, thought-provoking stuff. And then there is a retort from a former Coast guest, Bill Sardi. You remember him coming on the program to tout the benefits of something called resveratrol. It's a supplement that provides benefits from the same kind of benefits that you get from red wine, grapes, longevity, improving the circulatory system, other benefits. Perhaps you saw the reports this week that the health benefits of red wine are illusory, non-existent. So says a new study. Not surprised at all whatsoever. Are you? I mean, Big Pharma has been looking for a way to make us ignore resveratrol and other supplements, vitamins, things of that sort, for a long time, while at the same time they've been plotting how to make resveratrol available only by prescription to jack up the price. Bill Sardi explains how this new study managed to get the results they seemingly wanted. His implications is that the thing was rigged, that other important information was left out, but you can read it for yourself, make up your own mind. Lex also has posted a collection of photos on our website from an alien-themed art exhibit here in Las Vegas at our City Hall. Aliens, Area 51, great stuff. I think I might have to make an offer on a few of those pieces and take them home. Again, that and more found on our website, and you can look under the Naps News section. We hope you get a chance to take a peek. Time now to put out the dog, bring in the cat, throw another log on the fire, lock the doors, and curl up in your jammies under the blankets, because we're about to take a spooky journey back to the land of missing 411, where something truly strange, deadly, and thus far inexplicable is underway. We are joined by David Politis right after these messages. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. You know, you would think that if law enforcement and government agencies were told about a threat that has resulted in hundreds of deaths, hundreds of disappearances dating back decades, maybe centuries, that it's been happening over much of the world, but is concentrated in particular epicenters, clusters, if you will, you'd think that officials would be interested in that. Please tell us more, they might say. What could be causing this, they might ask. You'd think. But in reality, government agencies and law enforcement have seen the evidence for themselves. They've been told about this. They know something is going on, something weird and dangerous. And the response has been a big fat zero, silence, and worse than silence. They've stonewalled efforts by private citizens to get to the bottom of this, going so far as to issue veiled threats and to throw up roadblocks to investigations. David Politis, a former police officer, now author and investigator, has chronicled this mystery in a series of books, Missing 411. He was the first to spot the patterns, the first to bring this to the world's attention. And he is still on the hunt for answers. We're pleased that he chose this forum to unveil his latest findings as detailed in this new book, Missing 411, The Devil is in the Detail. Dave, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, George.
Let's start this way. Did you know or did you guess back when you started down this road that you'd still be chasing the mystery years later, that you still would not have any solid answers, that it would take you this far and this deep?
I think during that initial phase, maybe the first 2 or 3 weeks, no. But then after we started to get responses from the National Park Service about not having lists of missing people, not wanting to give up lists of missing people, and wanting to charge exorbitant amounts for those lists if they had to put them together, things started to seem peculiar at that stage.
Let's get into the response, because I think the response or lack thereof from the agencies, the various agencies, is almost as interesting as the phenomena itself. Let's talk about, before we get into describing the parameters of the mystery, how the latest kind of roadblocks that have been thrown in your path.
Well, there's a couple of women that disappeared at Crater of the Moon National Monument in Idaho earlier last year. And during that, while they were missing, they walked out into the area together. They both went missing together. They had little dogs in their truck. Their family members said they'd never go out for a deep hike. They'd always stay within eyesight of the trucks, et cetera, et cetera. Well, one lady was found after a week. The other lady wasn't found for over a month. And at that point, we filed Freedom of Information Act requests against the Park Service for information about the disappearance, details about the search, and since they now had the bodies, information about what was the cause of death. And they stonewalled this for 7 months. And then they sent us the documents about a month ago and essentially gave us nothing. They stated that they weren't the lead investigating agency, even though it's on their property. They stated that they didn't write any reports other than a brief face sheet about the initial disappearance. That's it. they stated that if we want anything else, we had to go to that county jurisdiction because they didn't have anything. And then they stated something that we've never heard before, and we don't think it has legal precedent, and that is that they withheld photos of the crime scene and of various evidence, saying that they wanted to protect the privacy of the relatives. They knew that they have no standing on protecting the privacy of a deceased person, but that's the first time we've ever heard them make a claim that they're trying to protect the privacy of loved ones.
You think they know that you're one guy, that you have limited resources, that you're not going to hire some high-powered lawyer to come after them, and they just are going to get away with dragging their feet as much as they can?
Maybe they think that, but there have been some things that have come up in the last month that have been pretty interesting. Some people I know from technology have come to me who know about what's going on, and I've heard the same thing on the internet and via Facebook, et cetera, from people saying that we should start a Kickstarter campaign to get the $1.4 million to force them to cough up the list.
$1.4 million. My gosh.
They say that they don't have a list of missing people, and they say my books aren't in enough libraries to qualify for an author's exemption, but if I give them $1.4 million, they'll come up with the list.
It, just off the top of my head, I think you could do it for less if you hired a really high-powered lawyer who deals with Freedom of Information Act stuff and sick them on them. Because this can't be legal. It can't be right.
It doesn't seem like it. It doesn't have that feel-good effect. I don't think that's what Freedom of Information was initially brought about for.
You've had wildly varying estimates, right? When you've had them where they've complied with the request, give you boxes of information at a low cost, and then they tell you some outrageous figure for what would seem to be a much smaller file.
It seems as though that certain files they'll readily give up, even on their own people. There's an individual, a ranger named Paul Fugate, who disappeared in Arizona while he was on duty, and they gave us a box full of documents for $40. It's still an ongoing case. There's some accusation that there's criminal element. Maybe he was abducted criminally, but they just gave us that. Other times they said, you'll never get a case when we ask for it. There's specifically a Stacey Aris case out of Yosemite. By the way, Yosemite, the biggest cluster of missing people in the world that fit our profile. The Stacey Aris case, they said we'd never get it. I asked why, and they said, you just never get it.
You know, this idea that the National Park Service does not keep a list, does not keep a list of missing people in say, Yosemite, it boggles the mind. It makes no sense.
This summer, a friend of mine and I were up at a national park doing some more research, and we were at a little satellite office for this park, and we saw this group of four older gentlemen sitting there talking, and you could tell that they really knew what they were talking about the Park Service. And I kind of got the feeling that one of the guys was either a retired law enforcement man with the Park Service or current law enforcement. I just kind of waited my turn until he walked out into the parking lot, and I walked up to him, and we introduced ourselves, and I said, hey, if you have a minute, can I talk to you? He says, absolutely. He was the nicest person you'd ever want to meet. Turns out that he was a retired special agent for the Park Service. And I told him what I had encountered, the books I'd written. I said, why did they take this position? And he says, Dave, it's a lack of integrity. Those were his words exactly. And he said, they should be giving it up, but they don't. He goes, I could tell you about many cases I worked where there were things that were very wrong, and they just dropped the ball, or they compromised themselves, or they did something that was unethical. And he says, it's just flagrant.
You've made the point, Dave, in your books, this one as well, that it would be pretty easy to keep this kind of a list. It's not like some gargantuan task.
I think maybe I said this on one of your shows last time, is that our group, the Can-Am Missing Project, will go out and purchase 183 clipboards for the National Park Service with a binder full of graph paper for each one of those. And we'll mail them to each one of those 183 locations. And we'll have that paper divided up by date, name, location, time, disposition, and this is going to be your list of missing people. And at the end of every month, when various parks send in their monthly report to headquarters, if there's a new missing person, then you just send it in with your monthly report. And somebody with a $500 laptop could keep this list at headquarters. This isn't rocket science. This is very easy to do.
I assume you haven't got any kind of response after making that offer. When we come back, we'll take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the roadblocks you've run into dealing with local law enforcement. Maybe your name precedes you, Dave. And then we'll examine how you got started down this road, what the parameters of this phenomena are. The missing persons cases we're talking about with Dave Politis, nothing romantic about them. They're flat out weird. When we come back, we'll recap the story for those of you familiar with some of the details, find out how David got started down this strange winding road, and we'll update it getting into his new book, Missing 411, The Devil in the Details, coming up here on Coast to Coast AM. Back now with David Politis. David, let's recap for the benefit of listeners who've heard you before and also introduce the material for those who are not familiar with it, how you got started down this road. You mentioned this meeting with a guy, his former special agent for the Park Service. Is that where it started?
No, that was several years actually into the event. I was doing some research in a national park on some other type of deal, and I was talking to some concessionaires in the park, and I kind of knew at the time that the National Park Service personnel wouldn't talk to you, but the people running the stores and things inside the park aren't employees of the Park Service, and they would talk. And I was having some success, and I noticed that during the days, a couple of people were watching me. It's no big deal. They kind of knew that would happen. That night, I was staying at a place off the Park Service property. I get a knock on the door, and there's a couple people standing there, and they said, "Hey, Dave, we're off duty, but we're National Park Service Rangers, and we have a story we want to tell you, and we know who you are, and you're a good investigator, and we just want to give you some info." Kind of leery at the beginning, but they came in. Both of them were really nice people, and they stated that over the years that they had worked at several different national parks, and they had seen a series of disappearances at each of their locations over the years. And at the front end, there was a lot of publicity. There's a lot of activity. That first 7 to 10 days, there's a lot of interest and a lot of news coverage. And after that, it's over. And when they say it's over, it's over. There's really no follow-up. There's really very few other searches. It's like it goes into this hole and it's gone. And it had them concerned because they thought that there was an inordinate amount of missing people at their parks. And they thought that there were certain circumstances inside them that they couldn't identify, but they said it just felt wrong. And they said that rarely would they find somebody, and if they did, they were in places that they shouldn't have been and didn't make sense. So I said, thanks. I listened, asked a few more questions, and after a couple hours, they left. And the next day, I was driving away, and I called a couple of law enforcement guys, and I said, "Hey, pull up these locations and see if you see anything unusual or you see many disappearances." And right away, the response was, "Well, there is something here." And that's kind of the way it got started.
I guess it would be hard. I mean, from the vantage point of all the work you've done now, from this vantage point, you can see the broad patterns. But I guess without the benefit of all the work you've done, unless you're a Park Service Ranger and you see them for year after year, it would be really hard to spot this.
It's really hard. And in the other books, I've explained that at the back of each book, I usually have an index of all the missing people. And I tell people to look at that index and look at the dates and the locations, and there's almost a hopscotch effect on the missing people. There aren't a lot in one location within a short period of time because that would really raise awareness. But if you have one, say, in Yellowstone, and you have another in Great Smoky Mountains, and you have another in the Adirondacks, and they're all about 3 or 4 or 5 days apart, it's not going to raise a lot of suspicion.
And that's what it looks like, is that you'll have the same general location, but they'll wait a couple of years. Whatever it is, it will pick them off in the same spot, but they'll wait for things to settle down.
Correct.
Is there, what are the patterns? Talk about the clusters a little bit.
So the biggest cluster in the world is Yosemite. And in the books, I identify that boulders, granite, there's something about being in a boulder field or being around granite that can be dangerous. And a lot of people disappear in those areas. And Yosemite has so many strange disappearances in three of my books. It's just unbelievable. In one of the books, I wrote about two University of California graduate students that disappeared in the late 1950s, 3 months apart. They didn't know each other. They were brilliant guys. One was vacationing with a family. The other was working there during the summer. They disappeared under very unusual circumstances. Somehow or another, and I don't know how, the families found each other. They didn't know each other in school. They didn't have the same major. Everything about them was different, except they were grad students from Cal. The families found each other, and they wrote letters to Eisenhower asking him to send in special forces to search for these two. Well, about 2 weeks ago, from the Eisenhower Library, I got 28 pages of documents about this. And it's very fascinating because one thing became clear is that the Army didn't want anything to do with this. And in fact, they lied in internal documents to the White House saying that they thought that these guys just got picked up on the road and taken out of the park and there was nothing to it. But they never said that to the press and they never said that to the parents, the best I could tell.
So initially, Yosemite being the biggest cluster, but there are, you started out noticing 28. How many do you think there are now?
There's 58 in North America.
Give me
and
a
the
list.
The unusual part about it, just in the last year, when we started to map the missing people, the Great Lakes comes out right away as almost the entire circumference of the lake at almost even geographical locations, there's a cluster of missing people. And so when you look at the map, what comes out at you is mountains and water. There's clusters in mountains and there's clusters in water, around water.
I guess the further back you go, the more cases you find. I mean, I can't even guess how many the total is now. It's certainly hundreds. Is it thousands?
I think we're at about 1,240 right now.
And you know that there are a lot more. It's just a matter of digging them up.
Oh, absolutely.
After Yosemite, what's the most prominent cluster?
Well, that's a tough one. I would say maybe Colorado or maybe one of the clusters in Washington or anywhere through the Cascades. They're all about even after you leave Yosemite. But it's very much far and away the largest.
How many does it take to qualify as a cluster? How many cases? Four, five, six?
Yeah, it's three will do it if it's if they're all within that profile and they're all geographically close, and I'm saying within 70 to 80 miles.
For the benefit of those who've heard you before and the benefit of those not familiar with this, let's go down the laundry list of characteristics. What qualifies to count as your kind of a case? What characteristics?
First of all, rural location. No mental illness of the subject or the victim. No water-related deaths or suspicion of drowning, no criminal suspects in the case. One thing we found just in the last year as well, this has come out and it's very troubling, is that there's people of extremely high intellect that are disappearing, and then there's people with disabilities and very low intellect that are disappearing. People like me, we're in that middle, we're not disappearing at as high a rate. Canines are involved in two different levels. That a lot of people disappear with their dog. And there's a lot of people that disappear and they bring canines, tracking dogs, bloodhounds to the scene and they can never pick up a scent. 99.5% of the time, they can't pick up a scent. Or they are unwilling to track or they're afraid. And it's hard to say what of those three it is, but it probably is that there's no scent.
I think that's one of the weirdest aspects. You've told me a couple of the stories. Maybe you can share a typical one where a dog just acts really weird for a dog that lives to track. I mean, that's what they do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're so excited to get out there on the trail and start doing their job. I can't even tell you how excited they get. And there have been times where the dog gets brought to the trailhead. They're given the victim's scent. The dog walks in a circle and lays down at the handler's feet. They've never seen the dog act like this before, and they can't explain it. Other times, the dog will get there. It'll walk up the trail 50 feet. It'll lay down like, that's it. There's no more. And handlers can't explain it. And I gave a talk in front of NASA, the National Association of Search and Rescue Professionals, 2 years ago. And at the end, there was a line out the door that wanted to talk. And a large group of handlers came up and said, you know, Dave, handlers don't talk about this much, but you'd be surprised how often this happens to us, and we can't explain why. And the other thing, the other part of this is that you won't find it in newspaper articles much, and unless the victim is examined by a doctor and a doctor makes a specific public statement about it, but the victims are often found with a low-grade fever. That's an unusual occurrence. It's not something that's normal. And if the victim is found alive, they're either found unconscious or in a semi-conscious state, but very rarely do they have all of their wherewithal about them. And then this one is a big one, and I think it's getting bigger by the day, is that the people are missing shoes predominantly, secondarily clothing. And I know some people are going to say, oh, you know, it's hypothermia, except the people take the clothes off too close to the point where they go missing. And the weather is too nice most of the time for the clothing to come off if they're claiming hypothermia. Secondarily, the people are taking shoes off where they shouldn't be taking shoes off. And that's a real conundrum. And in this new book, there's a couple cases in there where the shoes are off and this person's found dead at the location, and the instances don't make any sense at all. And a couple of the last things is that most of these disappearances occur between, say, 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. That's the vast majority. Somehow or another, berries are involved in many of the cases, blackberries, huckleberries. And in a large, large percentage of these cases, if the victim is found, they're found in an area that has been previously searched. And I'm not talking once, twice, sometimes 50 times. Sometimes they're found unconscious face down on the trail the searchers were taking every day out to search. And lastly, swamps are involved in many of the disappearances on the East Coast. Sometimes the kids are found in the middle of a swamp and nobody can explain how they got there.
You also have some really chilling cases about, in particular about kids, how they are counterintuitive behavior. I mean, they wander distances that are impossible for them to have traversed, and they go into really rough terrain that seemingly they could not possibly travel on their own.
Well, in the new book, there's a graph. There's two graphs in there with elevation and distances that kids have traveled. And it's baffling when you first get into this to think that, say, a five-year-old girl could travel 75 miles in 4 days. Or a two-year-old boy could travel 12 miles over two mountain ranges in 19 hours. Yet those are the claims made by the searchers that find these people. And this isn't one or two cases. There's quite a few that fit this exorbitant profile where it's, as a parent, you know, it just can't be true.
And they don't go downhill, they go uphill.
Exactly. And in some of the elevation cases, there's one in one of the books I wrote about where David Scott was found 3,000 feet on the east side of Yosemite above a campsite where his parents were camping. His parents told the sheriff at the time, my boy was abducted. I know he was. And he was found 3,000 feet almost straight up a mountainside on a switchback, down the other side and then up another mountain, nearly naked, face down, deceased.
These abductions, and we'll use that term for now anyway, they happen right under the noses of parents, in groups where people are hiking along in the woods. I mean, it's not just people wandering out alone getting lost, right?
No, and that's the vast majority of these happen, just like you said, very close to parents. And many times the parents have no idea this is going on. I was at a conference this weekend and a man was talking to me. He has a couple of young kids, and he goes, Dave, you know, what you said was chilling, and it makes me think twice about going in the woods. And he says, you know, I keep my kids in my view all the time, but you know how kids are. Sometimes you got one in front, one behind. You can't see them both. I said, exactly. It's difficult. And a lot of these cases, the child is the last person in line or the first person in line gets just out of view, and they are gone quicker than you can believe.
A matter of seconds.
matter of seconds. And when the person comes around the turn, there isn't that much ground coverage for them not to be seen. And it doesn't make sense.
I saw your reference in the book to an article that must have been done on Huffington Post where they said, don't be the last in line. It's kind of macabre humor, but it's probably true if you take these cases to heart that you list in the book.
Well, exactly. And Roger Marsh wrote an article about that. And what concerned him was is that being the last in line in a group or being the last in line in a family, and then you vanish, and then you're not found for days and days and days, and sometimes never found. Imagine the guilt associated with your family members who allowed you to just, you think you're in a safe environment in a county park or a national park, and you're just gone.
It seems like from reading all of the books that the only people or the vast majority of the people who are found alive are those who are unable for one reason or another to explain where they were. Either they're too young as kids, which is the big majority of the cases, or they have some kind of disability that prevents them, or they're so disoriented they can't remember anything.
Exactly correct.
And I mean, you think that's why they're allowed to come back, because they can't explain what happened to them?
You know, it goes without saying that that seems to be it. It almost seems like before these people are taken, somehow or another, they know that they have this specific disability. And I'm not talking about overtly obvious disabilities. There's a national or a U.S. Forest Service ranger that disappeared in Arizona. I wrote about in this new book, and he had a sister that had he had two sisters that had an extremely odd bone disorder, and I'm talking like 1 in 2 million or 1 in 3 million people ever have it, and he was the one person of the three kids that didn't have it, and for some reason this one article about his disappearance talked about this unique point in his life. And to me, it meant a lot because he didn't have the disability, but there was something about his DNA that excluded him having that disease. And he disappeared. He was never found.
You know, you mentioned about the intellect, either people with high intellect, college graduates, high degrees, and those with intellectually challenged people. It's as if they're something is culling the herd. Hey, let's pick off the best and the brightest, and while we're at it, we'll pick off the weakest and the easiest to grab.
That's a sad way to put it, but I think that after you read all of the books, I think you're going to come to that conclusion whether you want to or not.
At some point, well, we can start now. We're going to take a break in a minute or so, but I wanted to go through a list of what it isn't. It's not mountain lions, right?
So when a search and rescue team goes into an area, one of the first things they do is they bring in trackers, they bring in canines that look for mountain lions and things, and they're looking for that obvious sign of a fight, of a struggle, blood, hair, disturbed ground. That's one of the things that's excluded on the front end. None of these cases are associated with that.
There's no shredded clothes. The bodies that are found are not ripped to shreds or eaten, or I guess there have been some of those, but they don't fit the classic definition of the ones you're looking at.
No, and the coroners come to conclusions that, no, they're not eaten by bears. No, they're not eaten by mountain lions, or mountain lion experts come in and make decisions that this person wasn't attacked by a mountain lion for A, B, C, and D.
And so if it were mountain lions or bears or people, the dogs would be able to track them.
Exactly.
You don't think it's drug dealers or pot farmers out there?
And that's been brought up many times. And I say, with the number of flyovers that's done and associated with these disappearances, the last thing a marijuana grower or a lab wants to do is get any exposure by law enforcement to that area. They don't want to draw any attention to them. That's the last thing they want to do, and give up their crop if they're going to kill somebody or get rid of them. That's the last thing they want to do.
Yeah, the kind of searches that you describe in these cases are often these mammoth operations. Hundreds of people walking hand to hand. They use aircraft and FLIR kind of radar devices. We'll pick up that part of the conversation right after this. Our conversation with Dave Politis continues here on Coast to Coast AM.